Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Catherine Thompson is back once again with IPV Educators, and we'll have her reintroduce herself again here in just a second. But this is part of a two-part series, and hopefully a much larger series here eventually, because I think there are so many great topics that we can talk about. But this is at least a two-part series on human trafficking. Obviously, this is something that is pretty serious, and it's one that I think a lot of us maybe don't fully recognize just how significant this is and how much is going on, but Catherine is luckily here to help us and guide us on this. So the first part was more about the recognition of human trafficking and talking about the different types and the background and stuff like that. This time it's more about what we can do now to make the difference. But before we dive into that, Catherine, do you mind kind of going in a little bit more about introducing yourself again and what IPV Educators is?
My name is Catherine Thompson. I am the CEO and founder of IPV Educators and a proud physician assistant, 3 years running now. So to give you a little bit of background on that, prior to attending PA school, I was involved in the world of sexual assault as a sexual assault advocate. And then after becoming a PA through a series of extraordinary coincidences, I ended up as a forensic examiner, which I currently practice as, in addition to practicing in the emergency department. And that encompasses basically forensically interviewing and collecting potential DNA evidence off of victims of sexual assault, human trafficking, domestic violence, physical assault, and child abuse. And then that kind of led me, the more I talked to providers and future providers, and the more I taught at PA schools, that led me towards starting IPV Educators. Because I realized that there's a lack of information out there for healthcare providers, and overall, they don't feel empowered or educated in these areas. They don't feel they have the resources to respond appropriately to dealing with these victims, and we definitely are seeing these victims.
So for this reason, I thought it'd be a great idea for those who are already, especially out currently practicing like I am, who maybe a good reason we're not going back to PA school anytime soon. But for those of us who don't have maybe that kind of background experience, exposure, stuff like that, this could be used as a resource for us to help get that information and get that exposure. So that way, maybe we can understand this a little bit better, because this is challenging. I think just like any part of medicine or education, we need to continue to strive to improve. And fortunately, with Catherine here, we can talk about that a little bit more. So let's go ahead and let's talk a little bit about the background, just as a quick reminder. So we talked about this is a very common issue, whether or not we realize it. This happens maybe in certain areas more common than others, such as urban centers or along highways or those types of things. So there are different types. There's children, labor, sexual trafficking, and there are many different presentations, which I'd highly encourage, again, going back to the last podcast, to listen to all those types of details. But now that we have the suspicion, so let's say in our case that we have someone in the room we're talking to and we're really worried that this may be someone who is a trafficking victim, what can we do? Can you kind of coach us through what we can do, what can we say, and then what actions we can take?
Sure. Sort of not exactly picking up where you left off in this situation. One of the biggest things that I advocate for is pre-planning. So I think that this maybe this is a crossover from my fire service background, but you know, you train to perform kind of. And so in the same principle, the more kind of like pre-planning you can do, basically assuming that at some point you are going to run into a victim of human trafficking or someone that you suspect is being trafficked, the more pre-planning you can do, the more confident you can be in your approach to the patient on an initial level. So we can talk a little bit more about that, because there's a few ideas that I have, but the overarching concept are setting in place protocols for whatever department that you work for, or maybe like a resource book, so that you have the information and you know where to go to access it, rather than kind of like rummaging through, you know, an internet search at the last minute, because we all know that, you know, 15 minutes isn't even long enough to write a note, much less do an extensive internet search for local resources. So that's one of like the first principles that I think would really be important. And then another one is, and this one I get a ton of questions on, is on isolating the patient. So how do you, especially if they bring someone with them who you suspect may be the trafficker, how do you isolate the patient so you can talk to them in private? This again is something that you can kind of pre-plan for, that you can, you know, imagine and sort of like run through scenarios in your mind. I am absolutely not above using any means possible to isolate a patient that I suspect is being trafficked. I think this is one case in which in which lying is not necessarily bad. So a lot of times I will lie if I can't isolate the patient in any other way. I'll tell them, hey, you know, we're going to take the patient back for X, Y, and Z test. And unfortunately, we just don't allow loved ones back in that area of the emergency room. So you can just kindly wait here and we will be right back. And then I scurry away with the patient before they have really a chance to think about it. So I think that thinking about like where you could go, where you could isolate patients to in order to talk to them privately is also a really important first step in kind of intervening in possible human trafficking. And then basically we talk about how to talk to patients about this. And that's a principle that kind of crosses all these subject areas that I talk about. And I think that it's one of the biggest hangups for providers because they don't want to unnecessarily traumatize people. Like none of us are in the healthcare field because we enjoy torturing people, no matter what some of our patients might think. So it's kind of important to figure out how to navigate that conversation with people. I am a big proponent of honesty. So I don't believe in kind of like mincing my words or using softer terms for things. But I do think it's important to speak to patients on a level that they will understand and so they will really clearly understand what you are trying to do. So I advocate sort of a victim-centered approach, basically. And the victim-centered approach, the main principle is that, you know, first you want to make sure that the patient is taken care of on a basic level, that they are fed, clothed, they are not thirsty, they're not cold, they're not uncomfortable. Once you get them in kind of a comfortable and safe feeling environment, then you work on reassurance and trust and rapport. So that is where, like, you know, the honesty kind of begins. So this is also the point where I usually mention, you know, any sort of like mandated reporter type caveats that I want to mention, because I want to make sure that my patients understand what my limitations are as a mandated reporter. And I think that that actually does I think that it increases trust in patients rather than decreases it, because then they kind of just understand where the barriers are and what my legal obligations are. And then this is where language becomes important too. So I advocate using like very simple language, regardless of what kind of language comprehension level you think that the patient has. I go for the simplest terms and the sparest sentences. And I think, and then the, and after saying it, I advocate being comfortable with silence. So I think this is kind of one of the areas where a lot of these sort of triage systems for detecting human trafficking go wrong, because it's kind of the language is appropriate, but it's sort of said in a big rush with a whole bunch of other sentences. And then the patient is immediately kind of like pushed onwards in the process rather than giving them an opportunity to sort of think through what's being asked of them and what they might want to say in return.
I think we're all familiar with that. You know, the nurse who is going through the routine questions, do you smoke? Do you drink? Do you use any kind of drugs? Oh, do you get traffic? You know, it's kind of like that. And it's sometimes asked as blatantly as that. It's like, do you feel safe at home? Meanwhile, the person who's in the room is standing right there, because for that person, you know, that nurse, they're just running through their usual checklist. And for that patient, like you said, it's not even a real question at that point. It's just more to kind of cover bases. And they don't usually get a chance to respond, even if they are in a safe environment. And maybe that's someone else who's different with them. But yeah, I mean, we all have probably seen this occur because it happens so frequently.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I do think that the triage kind of systems of asking these questions have proven to be helpful in detecting some cases. But I do think that one of the things that's kind of like overall missing is that sensitivity needs to be a part of it. That, you know, we need to be aware of the power dynamics in the room and what we're asking the patient to disclose and how emotionally heavy that information may be. And so, like, you know, when you talk to, if you talk to like therapists or you talk to psychologists, this is one of like the biggest principles for them is the concept of being comfortable with silence. So, or being comfortable with uncomfortable silence. So it's not something that comes easily to healthcare providers who are generally kind of nurturing people who want to make their patients comfortable and happy and well. But to be able to say, hey, is anyone asking you to engage in sex or sexual activity that you don't want to do, and then leaving it and letting the patient think about it. The thing that healthcare providers want to do is to say something like that, to say, hey, are you being trafficked? Are you being forced to have sex that you don't want to have? And then being like, okay, no, great, good, awesome, moving on, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think we tend to not give enough of that pause. And there's an SGM podcast where recently Ken Milne talked about a paper where they went over and they did a survey with similar questions to what you're asking. And I think it's great to kind of go over because they do talk a little more about the actual technique of the interview. And like you said, there's pauses in there, which is important. And then being able to know the overall sensitivity and specificity, it can be a little challenging because you're working off of sometimes assumptions and not having full and complete information. But I agree. I think the screenings do help, but we obviously still miss certain people.
Exactly. The number one thing that I advocate is just being really like aware and sensitive to the environment in which you are asking these questions of patients and who else is present in the room. Now, nobody wants to disclose this stuff surrounded by five other, you know, somewhat harried nurses and possibly the perpetrator. So, you know, we need to be aware and sensitive to that when we're asking patients these questions.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about what we can do. And I really like the fact that you mentioned pre-planning because I also come from the fire background. I've been in for about 10 years now and still do it. You know, we've done our pre-planning, so at least we have some idea of locally what we want to do. We've identified that patient. Let's move first into our pediatric patients. So this one's a little bit easier, I think, sometimes in my mind because we are mandated reporters like you're talking about, and we can at least notify the appropriate services. We notify law enforcement, we notice child protective services or what children's division or whatever you call it in your part of the world. You notify them and you go from there. And we've actually talked about this on a different podcast and stuff like that. So that one, I think we can almost breeze over because that one is in some ways, given that's a relative term, easier because we have at least a little more support on that. But what about the adults? Like, what can we do? Because if they don't want us to pursue, I mean, is there anything we can still do to help them?
I agree that that pediatrics a lot of times has more kind of like resources for us. And the only thing that I would kind of just a little point on pediatrics. I mean, don't get me started about trauma interviewing for children because I also do forensic interviewing for children.
I would love to talk about that at one point, though. I really do.
But I could go on for hours about that. But anyway, the point that I would make that I think is the really relevant point for pediatric populations or for those under the age of 18 is that you need to be aware as a clinician in your individual state what the age of consent is and how what legal variations there are to that. So these things are the type of things you can access on the internet. And one of the important characteristics is knowing when a pediatric patient can legally refuse or seek out healthcare on their own without a parent's permission. So that's the only thing that I would kind of like raise about pediatric populations. Like in California, the age of consent is 12. So any patient 12 or older can decline or endorse any sort of like you know, sexually based like healthcare. So a pelvic exam, STI checks or treatment or anything else kind of like related to those areas, they can do it by themselves. They don't need a parent's consent. That's all I would really say about pediatric populations.
I did kind of breeze past it, but that's a very important point because I think that's something that we didn't necessarily directly cover on the last podcast, which I'll tie into the show notes too about that. So thank you for that part. So yeah, the question was more about adults specifically. So you have that like 30s or so female who comes in that you're worried about this being maybe a trafficking case. And understanding that this person can decline us calling law enforcement, but does that mean that we still have some other actions we can take, or what can we do? Understanding that state laws vary quite a bit.
Sure. So, I mean, first of all, as far as like language is concerned with mandated reporting, we must call law enforcement. That is, that's important to recognize that we must call them. The patient can decline speaking to them. So the patient cannot refuse us calling them, but they can refuse to talk to law enforcement, and that's perfectly acceptable. So that's just an important kind of like clarification point, because those two things would look very different. And then as far as what we can do about an adult, I get a lot of questions about this. Healthcare providers in general feel kind of powerless and very anxious about patients who will refuse their care or refuse their help. And I do think that is a really important point to kind of unpack a little bit. So it is absolutely true that we have very little ability to respond when an adult patient who is of sound mind and body and who is not either a danger to themselves or others, we don't have a lot of resources to kind of force them to get out of the environment that they are in. And that is really, like, I deal with a lot of kind of teenage or young adult trafficking victims, especially in these kind of like Romeo pimp type situations. And it's very frustrating and difficult to watch as a healthcare provider, because you can very clearly see from the outside that this person is suffering and that, you know, how much better their lives could be if they could just sort of remove themselves from this situation. But they are absolutely in denial and will refuse any and all resources you try to give. So the one thing that I kind of start with healthcare providers, the one thing I kind of start by reminding them is that it's important to realize that this may not be a problem that you solve in the exact moment that you see the patient, but it is a brick in the wall. It is a step that is, you know, a one step up that's installed. And so like, every time they interact with a healthcare provider and they have a positive experience and the healthcare provider respects their wishes and builds trust and rapport and is consistently there for them without judging or being kind of like forceful or angry about it, that is one more brick in that wall. And eventually you may have built an entire wall. And or may have been an instrumental part in building that wall. And so that's like the number one thing that I remind providers is that like you may not solve the problem right there, but you are forming an instrumental link for this patient. And so from there, it's really important to sort of be able to dispense local resources that the patient can access so that if they refuse your care right there, if they go home and start thinking about it and they're like, you know, that provider really has a point. I don't really like living like this. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. They have a place to turn. They have like resources that they can plug into that are accessible to them. And so the principles that I would say are that being trustworthy, being non-judgmental, being a steady presence in the patient's lives, providing resources and providing appropriate resources for the patient, taking into consideration that they may or may not have internet access. They may or may not have access to a phone. They may or may not have access to transportation. And so keeping all those things in mind, having kind of a series of appropriate resources for patients maybe in multiple languages that are often spoken in your areas, is going to be a very empowering movement for providers because it gives us, it sets us up for success.
So Catherine, I'm sure there's lots of great resources, but I'd love to have some that we can also include in the show notes for people to get some ideas as far as maybe what they can provide for their local people, just because obviously this can be a little bit of a challenge. And like you said, there's some regional variations and stuff like that.
Sure. So they're actually the number one thing that I would, and I will include this or at least a link to this in the show notes, but one of the biggest things is the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So this is a 24/7 staffed phone hotline, and they also have an excellent website with a lot of really excellent information on it. One of the things that they have that is, I think, is really cool and very interesting, that you can order for your healthcare environment or for your primary care environment or wherever you are, or shoot, if you want to keep a stack of them on your bookcase at home, they have these laminated cards that are shoe cards. So they actually they're very thin cards. They have the tagline kind of on the front, and they have the hotline numbers on the back and the hotline website on the back, and they slip underneath the insole in a patient's shoe. That's really valuable for patients because it can be hidden very easily from a pimp. So understandably, a pimp would probably not be amused to find information on a human trafficking hotline in possession of one of their prostitutes. So like, things that can be hidden from pimps are really valuable. So this one slips underneath the insole of a shoe. They also make a wallet card, and they also make like a little keychain attachment, like that looks basically like one of the grocery like rewards cards or something like that. And so that can also be sort of like easily hidden. So I can certainly include that resource and a few others in the show notes. There are a few kind of like national or international websites that are excellent for kind of gathering that information for your clinic environment.
And most of these cards too, because I remember we talked about this in person when we met at AAPA, they usually aren't blatantly saying like, this is for human trafficking. It's that they're either pretty subtle or only have a phone number, or they're disguised in some way to make it that much less apparent what they actually are. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I'm looking at one of them right now. It says help is just a phone call or a text away. And then it says to reach a non-governmental confidential helpline, call toll free 24 hours. Then it gives the number, or you can text. They also text. It doesn't say anything about human trafficking, sex trafficking, anything like that. So basically, it really could be kind of anything. And even the tagline is like, be alert, be strong, be free. So it really sounds more like kind of a women's rights organization than it does sound like a human trafficking organization. So I think it's valuable for patients because, like you said, it doesn't really overtly scream, hey, I'm getting help for being a sex trafficking victim.
Sounds good. Well, obviously, there's a lot more that we could talk about, but are there any other particular topics you want to hit before we wrap this up today?
I like to end these things by reminding people that, you know, just by listening to this podcast or just by looking on the internet for resources or just by inquiring about this or sitting in on a talk at AAPA or whatever it is, you are already 100% more informed than many people out there. And you're already helping. You're already taking a step in the right direction. So I think it's common for healthcare providers in particular to feel powerless. But I always like to sort of end by saying that, you know, we as a legion are much more powerful than we realize. And every tiny step that we take in the direction of being able to help victims more is a good step.
All right. Well, in that case, thank you so much, Catherine, for being on for both parts. Like I said, I hope we can have you on more in the future. But before we go, can you go ahead and give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.